These guiding principles haven't really changed. They've always been a fundamental part of who I am. I think kindness is, you know, especially for men, I think kindness is sometimes viewed as a weakness. I think it's a superpower. Kindness and patience and willing to hear other people's perspectives, I think, is something that we all need to do more of, but I think in particular men need to do more. It's just something that I teach my children and something I try to strive for myself. I don't always succeed at it, but I try. Two more quick things that are really important to me is have fun. Again, the world is a complex, it's a dark place at times. And I think I learned that from my mom is that, and it's so fundamental to being an entrepreneur, is being an entrepreneur is some days it's a 1 out of 10 and sometimes it's a 10 out of 10. And if you are not willing to find the fun in what you're doing, then you're going to, being an entrepreneur, being a founder is going to drive you crazy. Those are the two things that are non-negotiable to me. Try as hard as I can to follow.
Are an inspiring group of people. Every one of them, from the larger-than-life comic book heroes you see on the big silver screen, to everyday heroes that let us live the privileged lives we do. Every hero has a story to tell. From the doctor saving lives at your local hospital, to the war veteran down the street who risked his life for our freedom, to the police officers and the firefighters who risk their safety to ensure ours. Every hero is special and every story worth telling. But there is one class of heroes that I think is often ignored. The entrepreneur, the creator, the producer. The ones who look at the problems in this world and think to themselves, you know what? I can fix that. I can help people. I can make a difference. Then they go out and do exactly that by creating a new product or introducing a new service. Some go on to change the world. Others make a world of difference to their customers. Welcome to the Hero Show. Join us as we pull back the masks on the world's finest heropreneurs and learn the secrets to their powers, their success, and their influence, so you can use those secrets to attract more sales, make more money, and experience more freedom in your business. I'm your host, Richard Matthews, and we are on in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back to the Hero Show. My name is Richard Matthews, and today I have the pleasure of having TJ on the line. TJ, are you there?
I'm here.
Awesome. So glad to have you here, TJ. I know we were talking before we got in here. You are coming in from Seattle in the upper northwest. Is that right?
That's right. Just outside of Seattle.
Nice. Have you started to get the warm weather over there? I know it takes a little longer to hit you guys up there.
We have. It's going to be 70 today, and just to keep us on our toes, it'll be down into the 40s for the rest of the week. So we're getting a little glimpse.
Just like a little taste of the warmth is almost here.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. We were in Iowa a couple of weeks ago, and it was doing that to us where it was like 70 degrees one day, and then it was 27 degrees the next. And I was like, how do the Midwesterners put up with this? But for my audience, they know we travel around constantly. We've moved back down to Florida. We'll be in Florida for the next 6 months or so. And man, I got up this morning, did our martial arts workout with my son, and sweated it out because it was hot.
I know you picked the weird time to go to Florida. You should be in Florida in the winter when it's pretty pleasant. That's what I would say.
So we have done that because we travel full time. We've been traveling for 7 years. We have done the wintering in Florida and the wintering elsewhere and everything. And what I have found is that my family and I really enjoy the summers in Florida because there's nobody here. And it's a really nice thing. And we don't mind the heat.
There you go.
And okay. In the wintertime, Florida becomes a madhouse.
That's just true.
And everything is busy all the time. It's expensive. It's hard to get in and out of places. The weather is certainly nice, but there are other places where the weather is nice in winter that are far less of a madhouse than Florida.
Fair point. I hear you.
So that's why we generally travel and go visit friends and family in the wintertime and then come back here in the summer because, you know, it's easy and we can relax and spend the summer just water skiing and playing at the beach. And
Not a bad life.
So what I want to do before we get too far is just dive into your bio real quick so my audience knows who you are, and then we'll dive into your story. So TJ is a founder and nacho enthusiast currently living in Seattle, comes from Atlanta and Houston. He co-founded Standard Co. and before that, We and Co., both companies focusing on the intersection of data and impact. And when he's not nose deep in funky Excel spreadsheets, sounds a lot like me, TJ can be found cooking dinner for his wife, Megan, and teaching his daughter, Lillian and Nora, how to pop wheelies on their bicycles. And that sounds fun. And so what I want to hear from you before we get too far into this is tell me a little bit about who you are, what you guys provide in the marketplace, and just basically what you're known for.
Yeah. So Standard Co. is a company I helped start 11 years ago. And it was born out of another company I helped start called We & Co. And I'll tell you just this quick story because it's really relevant to who we are. So We & Co. was a company that we started. We had a very specific point of view of what we wanted to build. It was the LinkedIn for hospitality professionals. So my dad was a cook for 50 years. I bartended my way through college. So I had a real affinity for hospitality workers. And that company, we raised money, did that whole thing, and it just didn't work. And out of that, the wreckage of that company, we started Standard Co. And we took the opposite approach. We said, we want to build a product because we're product people, but we don't know what product it is. We don't know what we're going to serve. So we created this company. We did dev work, custom dev work for people for 6 years and said, we're going to figure out what product we are by working for other people. And so we launched 16 different products of our own over those 6 years. And the 17th one was the one that ended up becoming what we call Standard Data. So Standard Data is a data collection, management, and analysis tool that helps global health organizations. So I never in a million years thought I'd be working in global health. We help like the World Health Organization, ministries of health throughout Africa, countries in South America and South Asia. We help them manage their data as it relates to disease. So helping them figure out where is disease happening? Where do they need to send medicine to prevent those diseases? And what is the impact of those treatment campaigns? So that's at its most simplified what we do. We also use that same platform in education to help school districts identify at-risk students. Again, we went in with a very open mind of what we wanted to become, and we're now in education and global health. And I'm like, man, I never thought we would be doing that.
You never would have picked that out as the thing you were going to build.
No, never thought, like, you know, with global health, what's so cool about it is that we're really love the work we do, but we get to travel to these places. So I spend a lot of time in rural Africa, rural South America with the hands that we work on Android phones. And so like, how do we collect data? How do we make sure that data gets back to the, you know, principal investigators so they can make decisions in real time? So it's really fun and really rewarding.
That's really cool. And so it's a fascinating business. Like, right? We haven't had anyone on this show that does anything like that. So I'm curious, we talk regularly about on this show about your origin story and how you got here. Right? Every good comic book hero has an origin story. It's the thing that made them into the hero they are today. You know, yeah. We want to find out, were you born a hero, wanted to become an entrepreneur, or were you bit by a radioactive spider and you were like, you know what, I'm going to get into building software and see what happens? Where did you start on your job? I know you mentioned a little bit starting out in the as a bartender, but basically, how did you get here?
Yes, man, I love that question because I don't know, but I'll tell you the story. Maybe someone out there can figure it out for me. So I was born in Houston, come from a big family, two brothers, a sister, and three stepbrothers. And we moved to Atlanta and I went to college. I went to Georgia Tech, and I'm still the only one in my family to graduate from college. And I mention that because it was a real hard process for me. I shouldn't have gotten into that school in the first place. Don't know how. I flunked out. And then I went back. And when I flunked out, my folks were like, hey, man, that's a bummer. Good luck. You're on your own now. And I was 19. And so that's when I started bartending. And I went back to Tech and I graduated. But I graduated with such a low GPA, a 2.2, that no one wanted to hire me. And so I had no choice but to go work at a startup, because startups are like, we don't care. We're going to hire whomever seems to be a problem solver. And I think that's something, because I come from a big family, because my parents, I love them to pieces, but I've always been very focused on being resourceful, on being, you know, solving your own issues. And so I went to work at a startup and I found I loved it. I was like, holy crap, this is a place where I get to either invent the rules as I go or change them if they don't make any sense. And so I really thrived in that environment. So for 10 years, I worked for other people's startups, and I went from what we used to call a webmaster, if anybody remembers that, back in 2000, to a CTO of a growth stage startup in 2010. And right around 2010, I started to realize, I'm like, I don't want to work for someone else's startup. I want to do my own. And 2010 was a real sort of inflection point for me. And I met who had become one of my business partners, Jared. And he had the idea for WeEnco, the LinkedIn for service professionals. And so I quit this lucrative, paying, comfortable job to go start my own company, or to help start a company. And it's been the best thing I've ever done. I literally went from making, you know, well into six figures as a, you know, salary to like 35 grand a year. And I'd made that for like 3 years. I lived in this dumpy house and it was the most rewarding thing. And I'm so happy I did it. So I was able to take all those lessons I've learned at other people's startups and say, I want to apply them to my startup. When we fail, I want to be the reason we failed and learn from it. When we succeed, I want to be the reason we succeeded and be like, how do I grow this? And I think that whole story of, again, being resourceful and being really interested in keeping as close to the customer as possible is really what drove me to be. And I always like this distinction too. I am an entrepreneur, right? But I really think of myself as a founder. Entrepreneur is somebody who runs a business. I'm a big fan of the way I think of, oh, I started a business. I started something from the ground up. And that's a little bit of how I got here.
That's really cool. And I really like the thing you mentioned about, I liked being in a place where I could create the rules if I wanted them or change the rules if I didn't like them. That's one of the things that really attracted me to entrepreneurship. And
yeah.
I started off as, you know, any teenager working for like big company, like I think my first job was Subway, you know, sandwich artist kind of thing, like in high school. Yeah. And man, I hated it. And I worked for another company. I worked for Party City for a little while. I actually got fired from that company because I was not good as a cashier. And I was off like pennies every single day. And after like 2 weeks of being off by pennies, they were like, you're fired. You can't count. And I was like, you're right. I can't count.
Those jobs are like, I'm a big believer that jobs in high school are fundamental to like who we become, right? We get fired from them because we did a bad job or we did something wrong, or we learn from people from all walks of life. And I have a 5 and a 7 year old, and I'm a big believer that I want my children to be successful in school, but I'm even more, you know, interested in them having a good work ethic and knowing how to take direction from other people and knowing when they're like, hey, I would rather invent this thing than follow someone else's lead. You know, I want to nurture that in my children.
I also have a 5 and 7 year old. But I also have a 10-year-old and a 14-year-old, so I got a few extras.
We've been through it before.
Yeah, we've been through it. And that's right. Man, that's one of those things that like I talk to my son all the time. He's my oldest one. He's 14. About the work ethic part of that. And we talk about the business systems. And like when we go into restaurants, I have him point out the business system. So he sees not just the workers, but the systems that the workers are working in and the value propositions of every level of the business. Just so he sees it. I was like, whether or not he chooses to be an entrepreneur, I want him to see the way the world works. And so we do things like we'll drive down the road because we travel regularly and be like, hey, here's an actual farmer in their field picking berries, right? Someone's picking berries and there's 30 of them all picking berries in there. I was like, what's the value they're providing, right? They're providing the berry picking labor to the person who owns the farm. And I was like, okay, so what's the value of the person that owns the farm? Where are they providing value? They're providing berries to the market and they're providing jobs to all of those people. Right. Yep. And I was like, let's go to the next level up and we'll just go through all the systems. And I make him like see all of that stuff because it's like the stuff that most people don't see. They just see the person picking berries or they see the berries on their shelf in the store or whatnot. And so like I try to make sure my kids can see all the business systems that are making the world go round.
Yeah. And even if they don't end up becoming founders or entrepreneurs, just knowing how, again, the world works under the hood is, gosh, that's such a valuable, you know, resource to have.
Yeah. My favorite one is the sign flippers, the ones who spin the signs, which I think are fascinating. I love that they, especially the ones that really get into it and do the dancing and stuff. But I was like, what's the value they're providing to the world? You know, it's always sort of a crack up because my son has gotten to the point where he responds with, they're providing the value of a pole, a dancing pole.
Right.
Because, you know, a pole can hold a sign.
And
I was like, and they get compensated for the value that they're providing. And I was like, so you scale that all the way up to restaurateur, what's the value that they're providing? It's all the employees and the space in the marketplace and the food. There's just, as you go up, you scale the amount of value you provide to the world, it scales your value to what you get compensated for. And so what's interesting to me in your story was the idea that like, hey, I'm here, I'm in a comfortable place, I'm making good money, I'm providing good value, but getting into your own startup means that you get to control those means of production, right? You get to scale the value that you're providing to the world on your own terms, which is the reason I got into entrepreneurship is I wanted to be the one who was creating all of that. And I did something similar. I did figure eight kind of thing where I was like, I started an agency and then learned that I was really bad at business. And so shut my agency down and took a high paying C-level marketing director position for, you know, 18 months and like 10x the company and did a lot of really good work there, but spent that time learning how to do the business side. It was like mentoring with the president, mentoring with the CEO, mentoring with the board of directors every single week and learning how to run a business. And then I gave him like 3 months notice and I was like, hey, I'm quitting, but I'll help you hire and train a replacement, do all those things. And so I could go back into business for myself, knowing how to do the business side and not just the product delivery side, and left a six-figure position to go to nothing, right?
Yeah.
My wife and my parents are like, wait, you're doing what?
Yeah. I remember when I did this, my mom, because I am the only one who's graduated from college and I had a really good job. And I come from a working class family. And my parents were like, what the hell are you doing? And I was like, you know, my dad had owned restaurants off and on when he was in his prime and watched them fail and watched them flame out. And I think he was also like, I don't understand why you would do this. And I think for me, my big obsession with being a founder isn't so much that I get to now isn't so much that I get to invent the rules or control the means of production or any of that. It's really more about I'm fascinated with problems. And for better and worse, I love to solve problems and I love to dive into things. And I want to be able to say, this problem, even though it might not be financially lucrative, sounds really cool and could benefit society. I want to focus on that. And so it gets to my business acumen is probably not as good as it ought to be, but my product acumen is pretty damn good.
It reminds me a lot of myself. I'm really good at figuring out systems and solving problems. And then once I've solved the problem, I don't care anymore. I have to be really good at passing off the solution for a problem onto someone else. But I think that actually dives really well into my next question for you, which is your superpowers, right? Every iconic hero has a superpower, whether that's your fancy flying suit made by your genius intellect or the ability to call down thunder from the sky or super strength if you're like Superman. In the real world, heroes have what I call a zone of genius, which is either a skill or a set of skills that you were born with or that you have developed over the course of your career that really energize all your other skills. So the way I like to frame it for my guests is if you look at all the things that you've developed over the course of your career, there's probably a sub-skill there that you see tying all of those skills together.
Yeah.
And you mentioned problem solving, but with that framing, what do you think your superpower is in your business?
I think I love to think about this because I don't actually think I have any superpowers. I think I'm just stubborn about working on things. But I think because I come from a technical background, I was a software engineer for years, like CTO, but I was never that great at it. I will tell people I was a 6 out of 10 on my best day. Because of that, I had to develop soft skills to communicate with other engineers, to communicate with customers, to communicate with partners. And so what I think I do really well is I'm able to listen to people and understand what problem they have and how can we technically solve it. I think I spend a lot of time with people. I'm willing to travel halfway around the world. Like when I go to rural Botswana or rural Kenya, people there are always stunned when I'm like, oh no, I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm not data statistician or data scientist. At my core, I'm a software person. And they're like, what are you doing here? You could be in Seattle. I'm like, I want to see what you see and I want to be in your environment and kind of watch and learn from what you're doing. And I think that those combination of technical skills and listening, it allows me to provide solutions in a way that is very hospitable to people. I think people find that working with us is really easy because our goal at the end of the day is to find out what problem they have and solve it. And then the second piece, which is again, gets back to my founder roots. I love inventing things from nothing. I'm not the kind of guy who's going to go buy a franchise, right? Like a car dealership or something like that. Cause that's an entrepreneur. That's not for me. I want to take some problem in global health. How do we digitize data collection in education? How do we help identify at-risk children and create software and systems that solve those problems? And then once it gets to a certain scale, be like, okay, this is not what I'm good at. This is not what I want to do. This is not what I want to do and hand it off to somebody. And so I think those two things are things that over years of working and having to be resourceful, I've cultivated those skills.
So what pops in my head as you're saying that is you are at your core, a translator, right?
Because
you're bilingual. You speak multiple languages, right? You speak, for lack of a better term, you speak common human and you speak software engineer.
And on top of that, I love that framing because I think in global health, when we first got into global health, there's a language there to epidemiology that I was like, oh my God, what have I done to myself? In education, I've done the same thing where I'm like, what are we talking about here? And I think I'm curious by nature. And so learning not only software engineering, but also epidemiology and education and translating that to plain English has been something that I've become pretty good at.
Yeah. And it's what allows you to build software that'll actually use and it'll solve the problems. Yeah. It's because you can translate between the languages. And it's a hard thing for people to understand if they've never been in that spot before, where you're like, I have to bridge two worlds here. And like in my story, one of the things that popped up for me and where I had to do the same kind of thing was when I was the director of marketing for the big solar company for 18 months or whatever, we 10x their lead flow, is they did a lot of decisions by committee. And so the committee was all the C-level executives. And so you'd have the director of finance and you'd have the director of engineering and you'd have the director of law and you'd have the director of XYZ and you'd have me, the marketing director. And what would be interesting is the way that they would run these meetings is I had to learn how to navigate. This is one of the things that was really interesting. It comes right into that translation thing is how do you take this marketing campaign and you're like, I do need to know from legal is if what we're saying is legal, can we say this? And I need to know from finance, can we afford to run this campaign? And I need to know from engineering, am I lying about any of these things that we're saying? But what I don't need from any of them is this good marketing psychology because you're not marketers. That's not your skill. That's mine. Right. Yeah. And so like learning how to translate, I was like, here's what I need to know from you. It was a really vital skill, and it served a lot of things throughout my business, is learning how to be a good translator for what it is that you're working on into the other person's language.
Yeah. And I think a certain sense of certain amount of humility in going into a situation. And I think it's really easy to go into a situation, especially once you've reached 25 years of experience. You're like, there's not a lot of new problems that I come across. And so it's really easy to go into every meeting and every room and be like, I already know the solution before you even tell me. It's really hard to go in and say, I'm going to listen and you might surprise me, and be able to translate on the fly and be able to say, you know what, I don't know the answer to that or what have you. And I think that skill has served me well, is going into those rooms and being like, let me hear you out. Let me understand what you're trying to tell me. And then we'll suggest. And a lot of times the thing I thought was right is right. Again, once you've done this long enough, there's not a lot of new surprises, but I'm always surprised. There's always something.
I'm curious, with the work that you're doing, how often do the people that you're working with know how to describe the problem they're trying to solve? And how often do you have to help them figure out how to describe their problem, if that makes sense?
It makes perfect sense. And I think because, like, my wife works at Microsoft, right? And, my friends who work in big tech. So you're surrounded by people who are technicians, right? Whether they're in marketing or sales or PR or engineering, they're technically minded. In the world I work, it is very rare that I encounter people who are technically minded. So I have to help them understand the technology without overwhelming them with tech speak. And so I have to guide them. The other challenge with some of the work, especially in global health, is we work with very large organizations, and it is a committee. I'm on a committee at WHO that has 50 people. And so you're talking about, how do I convince these folks that they need a solution? And a lot of times in this, what I've found to be extremely effective is showing them results. So we will often go do things and do things very quickly and very kind of in an iterative fashion, just so we can demonstrate how it'll work. And sometimes we've done that without their permission and without breaking the law, breaking, whatever. We'll do things and then say, look, I know you told me you didn't want this, but let me show you this. And then they'll be like, oh my gosh,
they didn't
expect that. They don't know what they want. And it's been fun demonstrating how you can get success by doing small little things.
Yeah. One of the things I used to do with clients, I don't do it a lot now because we have a very specific lane that we're in. But when I was in more of a, we said yes to a lot of things earlier on in my career, we'd get hired for things that didn't have answers already, which sounds like a world that you're in. And we would tell people ahead of time, I was like, you can pay me to help you figure out what the problem is and how to solve it. But you're not paying for a solution at this point. You're paying for research.
Yeah. And we find that in global health, we still have a product. So everything we build is built off of our data product. But you're right. That's a good way of putting it. We still do a lot of experimentation, and a lot of it works really well and some of it doesn't. We have found in education, our other vertical, it is much more sort of boilerplate. How many kids missed school today? How many kids are failing ninth grade math? How many kids are whatever? And that is more of a turn crank. Whereas global health, it's like every project, every customer has some unique set of circumstances that require some amount of research and some amount of getting into the weeds that is both fun and sometimes a little exhausting.
Yeah, makes sense. So let's talk about the flip side then, right? So if your superpower is that ability to translate and to work on the fly and stuff like that with your clients, the flip side of your superpower is always the fatal flaw. Just like every Superman has his kryptonite, or Wonder Woman can't remove her bracelets of victory without going mad, you've probably had a flaw that's held you back in your business, something that you struggled with. For me, it was perfectionism. I still struggle with this, not all the time, but I've gotten better at it. I want to make everything a little bit better before we go to market with it. Tweak it just a little bit more. And one of the other ones was lack of self-care, right? Which meant I didn't have good boundaries with my clients or good boundaries with my time. So I let my clients walk all over me, or I would work for 15 hours a day, thought that would make me more productive. It doesn't, by the way.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I think more important than what the flaw is how have you worked to overcome it, so that your story here might help our listeners learn from your experience?
I know the answer. I know what my weakness is. I don't know that I have a good answer for how I've overcome it, is that I'm not a particularly astute business person. I even majored in management in college, for crying out loud, and I took all the strategy classes. Again, one thing that I am really curious about is the problem. And I'll use this very specific use case to illustrate why I'm not that good at it and maybe how I'm overcoming it. Is we have a customer that works in a very low income country, actually a country sort of overrun by civil war. And they were trying to figure out how to get midwives and doulas to pregnant women in a more efficient manner, because it's a hard to navigate country. So we built this data system that I was so entranced by this. If you can get doulas and midwives to these women on a more timely fashion, you could actually improve the birth rate experience for this particular country. And we worked a lot on it. And we've devised this data solution that actually helps optimize this and track all the birth rate in this country. And it's like an incredibly rewarding project. And because I was so fascinated by it, we got paid for it, but dude, it's not that much. And so I think one struggle I have is I get really focused on the problem and I'm like, I really want to solve this problem because my passion truly is the intersection of data and impact. Like I really want to solve that problem. If that solving those problems makes me a billionaire, cool, great. But that's not my objective. I live a comfortable life. I'm very happy and very content. And being not that great at business and knowing when to turn down projects, I think is something I still struggle with because again, in this case, I was just so fascinated by this problem. How I'm learning to overcome it is I'm learning to look at these like clients more strategically and say, look, we can do this one thing for you on a reduced budget, but it's got to be a payoff in the end. And in this case, it worked out really well. We ended up netting three new good paying projects from them in other parts of the world. So I think you just sort of have to say, in this case, I'm going to do this thing because it's going to make me happy and it's going to bring good to the world. But I'm also running a business, not a nonprofit. So there's got to be a carrot. And I think that's what I've learned over time is to balance the things I want to do with the things I got to do to keep the business running.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I struggled with the same problem for a long time. And I don't have a name for it, but yes-itis. You just say yes to everything because you enjoy the problems and solving the problems. And I realized from a friend of mine who is responsible for creating billions of dollars in revenue for the companies he works for. So I listen to him when he says things to me. And one of the things he said was like, you have to learn how to say no so you can learn how to say yes. And then once you can say yes to everything, say yes till it hurts and then solve the problem and then solve the pain. But you can't say yes until you learn to say no. And it's something I've been working a lot on. And it's just another way of saying you need to know what your niche or your lane is. What's the thing that you're doing? What's the offer you have in the marketplace? You know yours, right? It's a data, the intersection of data and impact. Ours is podcasting, right? That's what we do with our agency. We help businesses tell their stories with podcasts. And when we started saying no to everything that didn't fit in that lane, our business grew a lot. And it grew a lot because then we started saying yes to things that only fit there. And then we very aggressively said yes to those things. And then it fills up your plate with all the problems you want to be working on, but they're all in the right lane.
Yeah, and they're I think that's what we love about the education side of our business. All the problems we've encountered are components of the same part. Whereas global health is, again, there's things like we need to deliver drugs to this part of the world. We need to gather data. They're all global health, but man, they're not components of the same part. And that's something that we still need to be better about. Again, in that particular project, we said yes because it felt good. And it was good for me personally, for my heart, but for the business, it probably wasn't the best thing to say yes to. So yeah, it's a balance, man. It's trying to find that balance. It's easier to postmortem it and be like, gosh, why did we say yes to that?
I feel the same way. One of the things is we want to get into the nonprofit space, and we don't want to get into the nonprofit space because it's going to be immensely profitable for us. We want to get into the nonprofit space because we know there's a lot of nonprofits that if they had a system for telling their story better, that they would get their message out more. So it would be really beneficial for them. It feels good for me to be able to be in that space. So like, I know there's a couple of things. We have to, one, learn how to navigate the nonprofit space. But the second part of that is we need to have our profit side of our business to be profitable enough and to be in good enough shape that we can have a nonprofit wing of our business that is designed to be nonprofit. Right.
Yeah.
And we don't have that ability until we start getting to the point where, hey, our business is throwing off cash flow. Right.
Yeah.
And it's healthy enough to the metaphor people always use, put the mask on yourself first and you can help put the mask on someone else.
Yeah, that's perfect. And I think, and I love that your approach to it, because I think as a society, we spend a lot of time talking about profit of your small business. How profitable is it? What are your margins? And those are incredibly important. Let me be very clear. But we should also be focused. I think what I'd like to see is one of my big pushes as a founder and entrepreneur is to get more founders thinking about, yes, you need to make money because otherwise you will go out of business. Things cost. People cost things, servers cost things, stickers cost money. And if you're not focused on how to pay those bills, then you will go out of business. But we can also, in some cases, in a lot of cases, introduce good into the world. And I think the impact balance is something that I would like to see more companies focused on.
We've already started talking to the nonprofit space and got a few nonprofits that we're talking with. And at this point, it's just exploratory. Because I want to get to the point where, like, if we have our systems are in place that we're actually the company is making profit in the profit space, that we could offer our services at cost in the nonprofit space, that we would be able to do really good work there. And I don't even know how we do that. But anyways, it's just on my world of things to think about. And I know a lot of entrepreneurs think about things like that. How do I provide impact in the world greater than what we're actually doing? And it's interesting because like we already have that. Our baseline product has a lot of that. I call it the throwing the stone in the river, right? It's got the ripple effect where when we impact our clients, it impacts their audiences. And there's a big ripple effect to what we're doing. How do we make that bigger? You can add more clients, more paying clients, that'll make that bigger. But like those paying clients are producing profit. If we can take that profit and take a portion of that and put it into other things, like, I don't know, it's fascinating.
You can magnify your impact. I think that's wonderful, man. I think it's a great way to look at it. And I'm excited for you guys.
Yeah. Same with you. You guys have a fascinating place that you're in, a solution that you're making in the marketplace. And man, it just reminded me of, you talked about the global health, everything is like a slightly different problem. My son actually showed me a video the other day from Mark Rober, who's one of those big YouTubers. I can't remember which country it is, but it's somewhere like Africa, where they're doing something in global health, where they're trying to get medicine to people. And they have this slingshot airplane system where they put the medicine on an airplane and they shoot it across to someone. They can get people medicine really fast. And I'm like, that's in your world, but it's airplanes and shooting medicine into the sky and not data. But like, that's like the range of way people are solving problems in that space.
Yeah, it's super interesting because you're right. You're talking about parts of the world that are extremely hard to get to. And these elimination campaigns, the desire to eliminate disease, is absolutely impactful. If you can reduce the number of people who get sick by this group of neglected tropical diseases, if you can prevent them from getting them, the country's GDP goes up a corresponding amount. That provides more money for indigenous people, that provides more opportunity, better education, and for the world as a whole, we all benefit from that. And if it takes slingshotting an airplane into a remote island off the coast of East Africa, then we should be doing it because that benefits everybody.
That's one of the things. I just heard someone the other day, I was reading a book about sound money, and they were talking in the book about the only real resource that has an impact on the world is human time. It's the only actual scarce resource is human time.
Yeah.
And we have proven time and time again that every single resource that we have tried, everything from gold to diamonds to oil, you can name a resource, the more human attention it gets, the more surplus we have of it. And we've got hundreds of years of data to prove that. It never goes the other direction. The only thing that doesn't increase is the scarcity of human labor. And so if you have more human labor to the time, more human time to put into things, which is the only scarce resource we have, the more you can solve the problems. And what's fascinating about that is like where that goes into things. You mentioned this already. Birth rate has a dramatic impact on GDP. People not being sick, being healthy has a dramatic impact on GDP and on growth and ideas. And it's like the author said it significantly better than I did. But the idea is that more people who are healthy and fit and taken care of, the better our society globally is.
Oh,
every single time.
Every single time. And that's something that's been proven for centuries and centuries, where we're able to keep people, you know, we've seen our quality of life and all these indicators go up. And although since the smartphone era has launched, though we can argue that it's the quality of life's gone up. But if we can keep people healthy, then they're happy and they're productive and they're beneficial to society.
Yeah. And because the more people, the more productive, the more productivity, the more attention we have to put on problems, the more problems get solved, the more ideas for those problems. There's something magical about people and the community that we have, right? The community of humanity and how it's a constant upward cycle if we take care of each other.
Exactly. Totally agree.
Super cool. Anyways, I want to switch gears and talk a little about your common enemy. And this is going to be interesting for your business space. But every superhero has an arch nemesis. And it's the thing that they constantly have to fight against in their world. So in the world of business, we like to put this in the context of your clients. And it's a mindset or a flaw that you're constantly have to fight to overcome so you can actually get them the result that they came to you for in the first place.
Yeah.
So in this world of big data and impact, what is the common enemy that you have to constantly fight?
Perfection. Constantly fighting perfection. Anybody who builds software for a living and for other people will tell you this pursuit of perfection is, and by that I mean like somebody comes and says, I need XYZ. And I'm like, okay, I've built XYZ. I have a general framework for it. And I'll give you actually a real world example. So WHO is a big customer of ours and they approached us 8 years ago and said, the biggest problem we have is we send all this medicine to about 100 countries every year. And we track all of that medicine in a spreadsheet. And I'm like, wait a minute, a billion and a half tablets on a spreadsheet? And like, yeah, it's kind of crazy. And so we were asked to build a data system that would help them track all this medicine and optimize it. And in full credit to WHO and to the pharmaceutical partners we were working with, They let us run with this project. They gave us a lot of autonomy. And so what we did in that project is we launched one tiny little module at a time. And when something worked, we built on it. When it didn't work, we shut it down. And they were not in pursuit of perfection. They were in pursuit of results. And they gave us a lot of leeway. And because of that, that tool has been live now for 5 years. And right before COVID, we were able to measure the on-time delivery of this massive, it's actually the biggest donation campaign in the world. We were able to increase the on-time deliverability by about 12%. And that's a huge win. When you're talking about delivering medicine to children in sub-Saharan Africa, if you can get the medicine there on time, 12% more than you were before, that's more kids getting treated, fewer cost, blah, 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 blah. And I attribute that to WHO saying, look, we're going to iterate on this. The converse of that is we've worked on projects where they're like, we know exactly what we want the tool to do, and they're wrong. They're almost always wrong. We know what we want the tool to do. And then you spend years bouncing back and forth, trying to achieve a vision, a perfect vision of something. And the reality is in when you're building anything in the software world, is human behavior is so tricky to understand and really tricky to determine. And what makes people use certain things, what makes people do certain things is something you just got to observe. And so I think perfection is something that when a customer comes to us and says, we're not trying to get perfect, we're trying to get results, I'm always really happy. And they'd always say it that way, right? But when a customer is like, no, you know exactly what we want, I'm always very, very, very worried, because that vision that they have in their head is 99.8% of the time not going to work. And so working our way through that is tricky.
Big thing you have to fight against. I know it reminds me of the process we're going through right now. I mentioned before we got on the call that we're working on moving our operating system from one project management system to another right now. And there's a lot of software build out that's happening there, right? A lot of automation sort of software, simple script type things. And as we're building all of these things out, we're halfway building it in a vacuum and halfway like inviting our team to look at it, because we want their feedback, because they're the ones that are going to be using it. But we also don't want the limits on, hey, this is what we think we want to have done. And we want to have more of the open, like, what are the possibilities? What are things that we can eliminate? What are the things that we could change? What are things that we can make better? So we're trying to approach it from a little bit of like, okay, here's something that we've done. What do you guys think of this? It's an interesting iterative process. And we're trying to go through it quickly because we're trying to make this whole transition happen in less than a month. So it's definitely not a billion lines of code for medicine stuff, but it's a similar problem where we have vested parties, right? Those are our team members that are using the software, and their preconceived notions on what software is capable of and our capabilities of what we can actually build and how you navigate those kind of things. And like, you know, where does desire and reality all fit together there?
Yeah. And I think you have to approach any system, right? Software system, we're talking about technology, as if it's like a living organism. We all have evolved to become the person that we're sitting here today. And through natural selection in the real world and in the software world, it's an evolutionary process of building something, seeing what people want, seeing what they use, and quickly iterating beyond that. And I think that approach in 2024 is still something a lot of people don't fully understand. Again, especially in the worlds we work in, where we're not dealing with technologists, we're not dealing with people who are used to building software systems. So you have to educate them on that.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. So let's talk about the flip side then. Common enemies, what you fight against. Your driving force is what you fight for. Right? And you've mentioned this a little bit already. Just like Spider-Man fights to save New York, or Batman fights to save Gotham, or Google fights to index and categorize all the world's information. What is it you fight for with your company? What is your mission, so to speak?
Yeah. So our mission is all about impact. It's really about how do we leave the world a better, not to sound cheesy or hokey, but it's about how do we leave the world a better place than we found it. I think that I went to an engineering school, so a lot of people I went to school with are very technically savvy. And I think our society has put a premium on wealth generation. And I'm not opposed to wealth. Let me just be very clear. I come from a fairly humble background, but look, man, I'd like to have a boat or a cool car or whatever that is people spend their money on. But again, that's not something that makes me happy at the end of the day. What makes me happy is looking at a company, our company, and saying our core values are our curiosity, empathy, and craftsmanship. Those are our three things that make us whole as a company. And so how that manifests itself is we measure our success on how many children are treated with the medicines we help optimize. How many kids are now graduating high school who wouldn't have otherwise graduated from high school because of the data we provide. And so that's my driving force. That's the thing that every morning I get up and I'm like, if we can do these three things, I'll be successful and I'll be happy. And so that Yeah, it's kind of the thread that weaves its way through my life and the career I've had.
I know it was one of the things earlier on as an entrepreneur, I built my whole company based on revenue goals. I was like, I want to make $1 million in revenue. This is what I wanted. And I was like, I'm going to be a millionaire by the time I'm 30. Didn't hit it. Close to it now, which is fun. But along the way, hit a revenue goal where I realized I didn't actually care anymore about revenue, which wasn't that big of a number, surprisingly.
Yeah.
It was significantly smaller than I thought it was in my head. Because I was like, it let me do all the things I wanted to do with my wife and with my kids and was traveling and whatnot. And with modern technology and the stuff that we have today, it doesn't cost nearly as much to do the things that I wanted to do as I thought it might. And I realized that I was like, revenue is not actually going to be a driving force for me. It's not something that's going to make me get up and go anymore because I already hit that for that desire. So I was like, if I'm going to grow my company and continue to provide value in the world, I have to have a different, something else that drives me. And so I started looking at, for me, it was things that really get me going is storytelling and the opinion that storytelling is foundational to the human experience. That's one of the things that makes us human. And one of the things that makes us like a super species on this planet is our ability to transmit information via story. Yeah. And technology has only made our ability to tell stories and to transmit stories faster and easier and better. And so getting into the podcasting world the way that we have was really an outgrowth of that mission for us, is that like, man, there's something magical about storytelling. And if we can help our clients, help the businesses that we work with, help ourselves get better at telling good stories and distributing those stories using whatever the current technology platforms are, which right now is like short video and YouTube and whatnot, but we're already seeing some of the writing on the wall for some of the AR stuff and the stuff that's coming down the pipeline over the next, you know, 5 or 10 years. Yeah. Man, I like being on the forefront of technology and storytelling, right? So just like you guys are in the data and impact, that's where we are. And that's when we started shifting from revenue towards an actual real driving force, our business exploded.
Yeah. And that's kind of what happened with us, is like we as a company sort of doubled down on wanting to be more impact driven, and same exact scenario. I think we kind of got we never really had revenue goals, but we just had goals. And I found that the goals, again, for a small company was sort of like, it's like giving a 3-year-old goals. What are you going to ask, have a 3-year-old do? Their goal is to go out and run around and have fun and experience the world. I think the same thing about us is we got rid of all those goals. And ever since then, we've been, I think, a happier, healthier company. I think on a personal note, something you said just made me think about my driving force. My other driving force personally, but cascades into my public and into my professional life, is I want to be able to spend a lot of quality time with my kids. My dad wasn't really around as a kid because he was in the restaurant business. And gosh, those people work 70 hours a week. And it was really important for me to say, I would rather own my own company, be able to control my time, control how I work, so that I can spend a lot of time with my children. And if the sacrifice is that maybe I don't make as much money, or maybe I don't get as much attention, whatever the case might be, I don't know. I have been driven by that. And the net effect is my company, we're remote first. We're all of our people are remote. We don't have common working hours. We basically say, I'm an early morning. I'm up at 5 a.m. every day. I'm working 5 a.m. until noon every day. But we have people who work middle of the night. Like, what makes you happy and what makes you capable of spending time with whatever it is you want to do? And almost everybody in our company has a family. So for them, I want to be able to spend time with my kids and spend time with my family. And that, as another driving force, is creating an environment in a company where we reward people for productivity and results and not for being in their chair.
Hours
clock. Like, I don't care. I couldn't even tell you how many hours a week anybody on my team has worked for the last 5 years. No idea. I can tell you how productive we've been, and that's what matters.
Yeah, I have a name for that. That's one of our driving forces as well. I call it family first entrepreneurship. And there's a couple of tenets to that. And so the tenets are flexibility, impact, and income. And so flexibility being the first one is that I want myself and all of my staff members to have the flexibility to put their families and their communities first. And because our business should serve the communities that we're a part of and not the other way around. And so one of the things that I've always strived for is, if our company cannot handle you going to your kid's baseball game, the problem is not with you and your kid's baseball game. The problem is our company and our processes.
Yep.
And so it's one of the things, like, I tell all of my staff this. I was like, you know, you don't ask permission to go to your kid's baseball game or to your mom's surgery. You make sure that your team leads know when you're going to be out or something is going to happen and whatnot, so we can get things redistributed and whatnot. But communicate and then go do that and share pictures, right? Share pictures of your kids, like, show up for them.
I like that. I need to make that part of our, because we do all the same things, but tell us what happened. And I totally agree. It's great.
Yeah. Because you are a human being and our company is a part of your community. And so we care that your kids have baseball games and that your mom is in surgery and that you need to help your friend move this week. Those are things that are, they're important. They're important to us because they're important to you. And if you get to do the things that are important to you and your work helps support that, when you come into work, you're far more likely to enjoy your productivity time. Right? Yep. And I feel like there's just so many wins there. And to my end, one of the things that we were talking about, what do you keep track of? We keep track of revenue because you have to, right? You have to keep track of revenue for taxes and all the other purposes and make sure that you have enough revenue to pay your payroll and that kind of stuff. So you have to pay attention to those things. But
sure.
Those are the numbers that you put on this spreadsheet because you have to have them on the spreadsheet. But the numbers that I actually care about, for me, I have one on my dashboard. I know every single one of my staff members. I know how many people are in their family and how many people sit down at their dinner table.
Oh, that's awesome.
So like our revenue supports a certain number of people sitting around the dinner table and puts food on their table. That number matters to me more than like the number of employees we have, the number of hours they work, the amount of revenue that we make.
Yeah,
and then one of the other ones is when we put out new job positions and they're like, hey, we got a job opening. If our team and our staff is fighting with themselves to invite their community to come be a part of what we're doing, then we're doing something right.
Yeah. I love that. And I'm going to borrow the number of people that sit at the table because I think that's a wonderful metric. The thing that I'm really proud of is like turnover.
Yeah.
We will be the first to admit we're probably in the 60th percentile of pay. But to your point, like pay compensation is a combination of flexibility, income, how much do I pay you, and how much do you enjoy the job? And because of that, and over our 10-year career, we've helped train. Actually, we had a very robust apprenticeship program for years where we brought in people who came from varied backgrounds and we trained them. They worked for us and then they moved on. And a story that I just love about who we are as a company is we had met this kid, Abdul, who was a bar back at a restaurant. And one of our guys was sitting at the bar having a drink and talking to Abdul. And Abdul mentioned, I'm teaching myself JavaScript. And he's like, oh, really? What do you want to do? He's like, well, I want to become a developer, but I didn't go to college. And I come from a big family. He's Somali. And I said, why don't you come by our office? And we'll talk to you. And comes by the office. Kid's clearly super bright. He comes to work for us. He goes through our apprenticeship program, works for us for 2 years. And he comes to us at the end of the second year. And man, he's almost crying. I'm going to leave. I'm turning in my notice. Only because AT&T reached out to me. I'm going to take a lead software developer job at AT&T. He's now like a platform architect. And it made me so happy because he was a kid who otherwise people would have overlooked him. And this is a wonderful opportunity for him to really do well by his family. And so our company is really the few people who have left us. We've been like, give you a big hug. You're not leaving us. You're just going on to do something different. And so we keep everybody very close. And we have, in fact, our 10th year anniversary was last year. And we had like a group party and brought all our alumni back and said, we love you. We're glad you're doing something better because all of them are doing something better. And I'm very pleased with how we.
Yeah. That's the same kind of thing we're trying to build. I'm not sure that we're there yet, but we're constantly working on that. Where one of our core values is like, hey, you know, every member of our team is valuable and has value to provide to the world. And we want the time that you spend with us to help you achieve your goals. And we know that you're not going to stay with us forever. No one does. Right. So how do we make your time with us something that helps push you forward and propel you forward in your world? And I certainly hope we're doing a good job with all of that, but we're still young enough that we'll see how it all pans out.
All learning process.
Yeah, it's all a learning process. And it's such an important point for delivering the value that your company delivers is to make sure that the people that are showing up are not just cogs in your machine, but are actual like human beings that are showing up and are excited to bring their creativity to bear on the problems that you solve. And you just can't get that if you're not treating them like human beings.
Exactly. And that's honestly, if I think about when people ask me all the time, what do you aspire your company to be? Like, what's your exit? And I'm like, I don't know what I have no idea what our exit plan is. No idea. And in fact, I can tell you that my goal is for us to never grow bigger than 20 or 25 employees because I have had teams that were 20, 25. And that's when you start to disconnect from them at a certain point. And I love knowing my team members very closely. I think of them as friends. I think of them as family almost. And when you get to a certain size, and I've talked to other CEOs who've had big exits, and they're like, I'm really glad I had this $50 million exit, $100 million exit. Work was really great, as they said. But when it got to a point where I didn't really know who worked at my company, it was like, I didn't like that feeling. And I've talked to people who love that. They love the scale. Both are right. But for me, I know that I love the intimacy of a small team and the ability to know what everybody's, what they're up to.
I wouldn't mind a $50 million exit.
I mean, I wouldn't either. Let's get real.
But to that point, our company is the same way. We're 100% remote. all of our team is remote 100% of the time. They set their own schedules. And we talk about that flexibility impact income all the time. And it's useful to me to hear of other successful companies that are following that, because there's not a lot of companies that are doing what we're doing and operating that way. And so there's always that question back in your mind of like, am I doing this? Am I crazy?
Because the metrics of success, and when you talk to other entrepreneurs, you always like, how big is your company? How many people do you have? And it used to be prior to COVID, and I come from Atlanta, where Atlanta is a little bit more conservative and old school than Seattle, but it was like, how big is your office? How many square feet do you have? And how many employees do you have? Or proxies for how big is your company? And I hate those questions because I think they're bullshit. I would much rather talk about what are we doing and who are we impacting? And if you want to know how much money, what our revenue is, just ask me, I'll tell you.
It's like revenue, I said, the more important questions to me are like, how many clients are we serving? And are we solving their problems? Are they excited about it? And how do our team members feel about being a part of what we're doing?
Yeah, great. I love it. Yep. Bingo.
So, okay, I got a couple more questions for you. This one's practical, right? They call this the hero's tool belt. And just like every superhero has their tool belt with awesome gadgets, like their batarangs or their web slingers, their laser eyes, or a big magical hammer they can spin around and fly with. I'm going to talk about the top one or two tools you couldn't live without in your business for the work that you do. It could be anything from your notepad to your calendar to something you use for your marketing tool, something you use for your product delivery, something you think is essential to getting your job done every day as the founder of your company.
Well, there's three things. The first is a notebook. I have to write down, I have to take notes because it does something in my brain that helps me remember things. So a notebook, I never go anywhere without it. I'm always writing in it, work stuff. The second one is obvious, but come on, smartphones, y'all, especially where I go, the ability to, I mentioned earlier going to Botswana and being in a remote village. I literally did that several years ago. And I was talking to our tech team on the phone in this remote village. They had faster broadband speeds than I have in Seattle, by the way. And the ability to have that communication was instrumental in us resolving some issues they were having. And then the third one is Notion. I've used so many different systems, whether it's Trello or Asana or you name it. I've tried everything. And Notion's the first one that feels like my brain organized in a software platform. And so we've all talked about the things that kill email. And we thought it was Slack or Teams or whatever. It truly has been Notion for us internally. We almost never send internal emails. In fact, maybe one in the last month. It's all in Notion.
Yeah. We used ClickUp for a good long time until it started having a problem. And now it's SmartSuite. And SmartSuite is the first time I've been into a relational database program. I tried Notion. Notion didn't quite work the way my brain worked. And what I've realized is a lot of these programs, they're all the same thing. Right? They're relational databases with project management features put together. Yeah. And it's like when you find the UI for a relational database that just makes sense to you, changes your world.
It does. It really does. I love it. Yeah, I'm in Notion. All the software that I'm in every day, it's the number one thing I'm in.
So like just like on that, one of the things that I just finished building this morning in our new SmartSuite database, when we get off of this recording, right? Because we run a podcast company. So this podcast is a client of our company's. So when we get off here and we click the little leave session button in Squadcast, it's actually going to go right over to SmartSuite and it'll automatically assign it to the show managers. It'll automatically put the tasks things on there and it'll automatically like hit up the AI tools and transcribe this episode for us and put the transcription files in there automatically. Like all this stuff just happens because of relational databases and automations. And I'm like, oh man, I don't know how, like it's smartphones, the internet and relationship databases with automations are like the chef's kiss of being able to run a business nowadays. Because I actually went through an experiment, maybe 2 years ago now, where I put my laptop and I stuck it in my cabinet. I was like, I'm not going to take it out for 6 months. And I'm only going to run my business from my cell phone. And the reason for that is because I was trying to get over the I am a worker in my business and instead of the leader of my business. And if I put my laptop away, it was very difficult to actually do work product, but it was significantly easier to manage the oversight of work product. And so forcing myself to use my cell phone for 6 months, it helped force me to change habits on how I was actually getting stuff done and forced me to delegate and those kind of things. But as man, cell phones allow you to do that nowadays. Nuts.
I love that experiment. I want to tell you, I did something similar back in 17. I did a sabbatical. So we allow people to do a month long sabbatical after five years. And so I was one of the first to do it because I was the founder. And I love to tell, it was the worst month of my life. And then the next 3 months, the month was great. The next 4 months were the worst of my life. And it's because of I'm a worker leader and not a leader worker or just a leader. And gosh, I just can't figure out how to get myself out of, I love doing, I love building, I love making things. And so that whole process was really painful for me. And it taught me a lot about what I'm not good at. And to that end, as a company, I think as our growth continues in the direction it's going in the next couple of years, it's very likely you'd be looking for a CEO to run a true growth stage company, because I'm just not that person. I like all my hands in the cookie jar.
I have discovered the same thing about myself, and I'm not there yet, but I know revenue wise when we need to hire a CEO and when we can afford them.
Yeah.
Because I have that in my spreadsheet. This is when I can get myself out of this role, because I have to do it and I'm getting better at it. What I've realized as a founder of a company is that you have to protect your energy at all costs.
Yes.
There's other things people think you should protect. It's your energy. Your energy is the thing that you need. And it's, what is the work that makes you come alive? And the work that makes you come alive is the work that you should be working on in your business. Yeah. And so, like, totally. I know what that is for me. It's probably very similar for you, right? It's the systems and the software and the problem solving that I'm really good there and seeing and being able to translate into, this is how it impacts the outcomes for our clients, or how it impacts the workload for our client, for our staff. Those are the two areas that we care about. And I'm really good there. But when it's like, I have to figure out, how do you manage the growth, and how do you manage the team leads, and how do you manage the financial parts and all the other things that go into running a business? I'm like, all of that is draining, but the problem solving is not. So how do I build a business? I just do this one thing. It's funny now, but my wife and all four of my children left for a weekend to go see grandma, and I stayed home. So I was home alone for 3 days. This was 2 months ago. And I don't usually get a lot of 3 days at home by myself, because I've got a wife and four children, and we travel full time. So it's a rare occurrence. I forgot to eat for 3 days straight and only slept like a couple of hours, and I created all sorts of stuff. And when Monday rolled around and I started showing my team, and they were like, can we make this a quarterly occurrence where your family leaves you alone for 3 days? Because we need more of that.
Oh my God. That's hilarious, because I obviously never forget to eat. But when I'm home alone, I do a lot of yard work, because one of the other things we do with our employees is we incentivize and we encourage the team to walk away from the computer. Step away every 2 or 3 hours, just go do something. For me, I go pull weeds in my yard, or I'm in my office. I built my office in the backyard. And so that was a labor of love. But this idea that being in front of your computer and the number of hours you work is important. No, that's crap. We're not designed for that. Being alone, like, I get into all kinds of mischief, but it's usually household.
I have the same kind of thing going, where I have to have things I'm working on that are not business related. So they're generally, for me, it's like skill things that I want. And so over the last 7 years, I've taught myself carpentry and plumbing and fiberglass repair and juggling and piano and drawing and cabinet building. I mean, just all sorts of other things. So, like, I always have a project going. Like, I learned to make edge grain cutting boards, and I made myself and a friend of mine edge grain cutting boards. I always have projects like that. When I have time to step away, I step away. I did carpentry so I could rebuild my desk. So, like, my desk here has my keyboard drawer. I push my keyboard drawer in and I can pull out my keyboard, which is legitimately a piano.
Cool.
I have a piano under my keyboard drawer. And so when I have 5 minutes between work, I can push in the keyboard and pull out the keyboard and practice and things like that. So
I love that. That's great, man.
I feel the desire to go out and, you know, work on things and pull weeds and do whatever. So
there you go.
Speaking of heroic tools, I want to take a few minutes to tell you about a tool we built that powers the Hero Show and is now this show's primary sponsor. Hey there, fellow podcaster. Having a weekly audio and video show on all the major online networks that builds your brand, creates fame, and drives sales for your business doesn't have to be hard. I know it feels that way because you've tried managing your show internally and realize how resource intensive it can be. You felt the pain of pouring 8 to 10 hours of work into just getting 1 hour of content published and promoted all over the place. You see the drain on your resources, but you do it anyways because you know how powerful it is. Heck, you've probably even tried some of those automated solutions and ended up with stuff that makes your brand look cheesy and cheap. That's not helping grow your business. Don't give up, though. The struggle ends now. Introducing Push Button Podcasts, a done-for-you service that will help you get your show out every single week without you lifting a finger after you've pushed that stop record button. We handle everything else: uploading, editing, transcribing, writing, research, graphics, publication, and promotion, all done by real humans who know, understand, and care about your brand almost as much as you do. Empowered by our own proprietary technology, our team will let you get back to doing what you love while we handle the rest. Check us out at pushbuttonpodcast.com/hero for 10% off the lifetime of your service with us, and see the power of having an audio and video podcast growing and driving micro celebrity status and business in your niche without you having to lift more than a finger to push that stop record button. Again, that's pushbuttonpodcast.com/hero. See you there. Now back to the Hero Show. I got one more question for you as we wrap up this interview, and that is your guiding principles, right? One of the things that makes heroes heroic is that they live by a code. For instance, Batman never kills his enemy. He only ever brings him to Arkham Asylum. So as we wrap up the interview, I want to talk about the top one or two principles that you use regularly in life. No. Maybe something you wish you had known when you first started out as an entrepreneur.
These guiding principles haven't really changed. They've always been a fundamental part of who I am. I think kindness, especially for men, I think kindness is sometimes viewed as a weakness. I think it's a superpower. Kindness and patience and willing to hear other people's perspectives, I think is something that we all need to do more. But I think in particular, men need to do more of it. It's just something that I teach my children and something I try to strive for myself. I don't always succeed at it, but I try. Two more quick things that are really important to me is have fun. Again, the world is a complex, it's a dark place at times. And I think I learned that from my mom is that, and it's so fundamental to being an entrepreneur. Being an entrepreneur is some days it's a 1 out of 10 and sometimes it's a 10 out of 10. And if you are not willingness to find the fun in what you're doing, then you're going to, being an entrepreneur, being a founder is going to drive you crazy. Those are the two things that are non-negotiable to me. Try as hard as I can to follow.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the kindness. And on the fun one, I call that permission to play. As an entrepreneur, you have to give yourself permission to play and give your team permission to play, give your family permission to play. And the shortest way I can describe it for people is that we regularly have this metaphor in our life that you want to legal scales, get your work-life balance to like balance out. I've always hated that because that's not really the way the world works. And it's not really the way that when you're passionate about something in a project that you're going to try and balance it out. And I'll spend 5 hours today on my business and 5 hours today doing something else. It's just not the way the world works. And so my metaphor for people is a rubber band, right? And you have a rubber band, you can stretch a rubber band, right?
Yeah.
And then if you want to make forward progress, you let go of one side and it shoots forward, which necessitates the rubber band going back to, you know, the relaxed state. And so it cycles back and forth. But if you take that rubber band and you can just continue stretching it, eventually it snaps, right? It breaks. Yeah. So you can't do that. You can't actually get forward momentum by continuing to pull the rubber band. Or you can just stretch it out so it'll never go back into a thing and you won't be able to accomplish forward momentum. And so you have to have this cycle of work, rest, play, recreation. And you realize that as you start implementing that in your life, that rest and recreation aren't rewards for a job well done. They are, in fact, prerequisites for showing up and doing good work. Yep. And so when you understand that, it changes the way that you structure your life and it changes the way that you structure the work environment for your employees. Because if you want them to show up and do good work, they have to have permission to play.
Totally agree with that. And I think a manifestation of that in my company is we haven't been as good about it the last year or so, but for the first 9 or 10 years of our existence, we were all about balancing. We did the 20% rule from Google of like 80% of your work should be focused on work and 20% it should be play. If you want to build something goofy, for me, I mentioned at the very beginning of my bio, I'm a nacho enthusiast. I love nachos. Nachos are delicious. They don't get enough attention compared to tacos and burritos. So I built something called the Database of Nachos. So I built every restaurant that serves nachos is on a map, databaseofnachos.com. As a company, we have so many goofy little websites and things. We have a fake employee named Gerald. And so I think what we try, because we work in a serious line of work, we work in global health and education, which are very serious and require serious thought. But we love nachos. We love fake employees. We love doing goofy shit. Let's do more of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a huge fan of that. I'm going to check out Database of Nachos because I agree with you. Nachos, especially the ones that are like the ultimate nachos where they're like, they put beans and sour cream and guacamole and like carne asada on them. Like, that
exactly.
I think that's a great place to wrap our interview. But I do have a challenge I run at the end of all of my episodes called the Heroes Challenge. It's just a simple challenge to help us find access to stories we might not otherwise find on our own. So the question is simple. Do you have someone in your life or in your network who you think has a cool entrepreneurial story? Who are they? First names are fine. And why do you think they should come share their story with us on the Hero Show? First person that comes to mind for you.
Guy named Morgan. Morgan lives out in Hawaii, and he is helping to run a startup that helps people go through the grieving process when a loved one dies. And I think it's a really cool area to work in and something underserved. So he's a great guy and does neat work.
Awesome. We'll see if we can get an introduction to him. Maybe he'll come on and share his story with us. But in comic books, there's always the crowd of people at the end who are cheering and clapping for their acts of heroism. So our analogous to that as we close out this interview is, where can people find you if they want your help? If they're in those spaces, where can they light up the bat signal and say, hey, TJ, we'd love to get your help with our data and impact? But I think more importantly than where is, who are the right types of people to reach out and ask for that assistance?
So you can find me if you Google my last name, Muehlman, Muehlman, TJ Muehlman. You'll find me on LinkedIn. You'll find me on my website, muehlman.com. or standardco.de. Those are all places you can find me. I love talking to entrepreneurs. I'm very real. So I will just tell you how it is, the good and the bad. I'm very authentic that way. And so love to talk to anybody, help anyone out that might need help.
Well, thank you so much, TJ. We'll make sure we get those links in the show notes for this episode. Do you have any final words of wisdom for our audience before this is a stop record button?
I look forward to seeing more people take on the founder journey because it's a wonderful job.
Thank you, TJ.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Hero Show, where we work to shift the cultural narrative around entrepreneurship and celebrate the heropreneurs who make our world a better place. Don't forget to visit our website at theheroshow.tv, where you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, or via RSS, so you'll never miss an episode. If you found value in our show, we'd truly appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or better yet, share it with a friend to help us spread the message of entrepreneurship as a force for good. Curious to learn more about the stories and insights of these incredible heropreneurs? Check out our in-depth interviews and resources on our website. Together, let's support and inspire the next generation of entrepreneurs as they embark on their own heroic journeys. Join us again next week for another episode of The Hero Show, where we'll continue to explore the world of heropreneurs, their superpowers, and the positive impact they bring to our lives. Until then, stay heroic.